About a month ago, I think it was, maybe a month and a half, I was listening to something in the afternoon as I was driving around, and this really great story came on. It's a story that I'm really a sucker for, because it's the story of somebody discovering something that they hadn't anticipated finding. Have you ever heard those stories, like where somebody like scans a painting and they find like an ancient masterpiece underneath it? I just think those are so cool. And this was a story like this is about an archivist at the Smithsonian Institute who worked in the thing around music. The music archive at the Smithsonian, and he was going through this, and he comes upon a reel of tape, and there's just a couple things on it that are written there. It says, on a piece of tape, T period Monk, Carnegie Hall, 1957. And this guy, he starts getting a little excited, so he peels the thing off, and he runs the tape into the reel, and he starts playing it. And he comes to discover that this is a taping of a very famous concert that nobody ever knew had been recorded. And so this story is about the telling of this thing. And the thing that's amazing about this story is that it represents, I guess 1957, for those people who are jazz fans, is a very fertile time in the jazz world. There's just all kinds of cool things going on. And Thelonious Monk is this pianist. He plays, and he does this concert. And they don't know who the engineer was that set this thing up, but supposedly this person just placed mics in the most amazing places around this deal. And it's really this unique window on a specific time in kind of the history of jazz, because you have T. Monk, Thelonious Monk, who's at the kind of top of his game playing piano, and then a very young John Coltrane, who's a saxophonist, and the two of them are throughout this whole deal. Now, I totally am a hack musician. I like to play guitar. I sing a little bit, so I don't know a whole lot about music, but one of the things I'm getting to understand about jazz is the idea of jazz is that there are themes or motifs that work their way through an entire piece of music. Those of you who are kind of musicians, you know what I'm talking about. Like, and that's what makes jazz improvisation and impromptu musicianship so extreme, because they just have this basic framework musically of themes and motifs, just these, you know, kind of auditory identity. And then what the jazz musicians do is they do variations on these themes. And so there'll be this underpinned kind of musical motif making through a composition, sometimes 7 minutes, sometimes 15 minutes long. And then Monk will be playing, and he'll go all over the place, and somehow it always resolves. And then John Coltrane will go through this thing, and it will resolve a certain way. That's the idea of jazz. Well, see, we've been going through this series for the last month. This is our fourth Sunday in Advent, and we've been, especially for those of you who've been away, we've been kind of studying in Luke's gospel, the songs of Luke. That's peppered throughout the first two chapters of Luke's gospel are these accounts of the coming of Christ. And at different times, God's Spirit, through an angel or through a messenger, reveals the scope of what he's going to do. In a couple different places, he's met the messenger or whoever with like this explosion of song. So Zechariah, this old man serving in the temple, and his wife Elizabeth, have an angel appear to them and tell them that their son's going to be John the Baptist, the forerunner of the Messiah, and the song springs out of him. And then Mary is told she is favored among women, and that God will raise her up. We sang the song tonight that she sang, Magnificat. And then last week we looked at the story of the angels, and the angels appearing in the field to the shepherds saying, glory to God in the highest. Peace on earth and goodwill to men on whom his favor rests. And as we've done these kind of teachings around these songs, we've kind of done it in a kind of prose way. We've taken this poetry and we've created these compositions that we call sermons, right? And we've used these sermons, this prose, to describe this very poetic art form. And so this is a big interdiction. It's not going to be this great, okay? Shane and I are going to do an interpretive dance tonight. No. No, but what? Don't get your hopes up. Anyway, the idea is that this evening, in the spirit of John Coltrane and T. Monk, that this sermon, right, would be a little bit more jazz-like, a little bit more improvisational. We're going to team teach tonight, something that we've never done before. And we're going to look at this passage that we've been in, and really, we haven't formed a tight composition. What we did this week is we tried to prepare in a different way. We tried to read the passage a couple different times and let that thing make impressions on us. And to listen differently for more like the idea of doing variations or riffing on a motif or on a theme. And so I'm going to stand up here for a few minutes, and I'm going to share some things that really have kind of impressed me in a kind of musical way related to this passage. And then I'm going to hand it over to Shane, and he's going to do the same thing. And then we're going to do some reflecting together and then ask you guys for some reflections as well. But in essence, what you do when you listen to jazz, and I'm just a neophyte at this, but you begin to listen for threads. You listen for themes, and then you see how the artist develops them and varies from them and uses dissonance and consonants to create this kind of rich musical tapestry that just kind of creates another world. And that's, in essence, how we want to approach the Scriptures tonight, in a little bit more of a whimsical way. And you know what? It could be a disaster, right? I mean, most of what makes it onto a CD in a jazz concert are the best of the best, right? We don't hear too many bad jazz recordings, but I bet if you're a music teacher and you have a sixth grade jazz class, so that may be more like that, okay? You know, little atonal, little weird kind of melodies, things going on here. But nevertheless, as I read the Scriptures, as Shane and I talk about this, it seems like so much of the Scriptures themselves are unscripted. That there are people who are like you and I reacting to some kind of weird reality that's happened as a result of Yahweh breaking into their lives. And so tonight, as we kind of interact with this passage and this teaching, that's kind of the spirit that we want to have. We're just going to kind of goof around a little bit as it relates to this. So if you've turned to Luke chapter 2, we'll dive in here. Now, here's what I'm going to do, kind of like we did last week. I'm going to describe the first part of this passage, then I'm going to read to you a second part, and then we're in unison going to recite the song, the singing part of this, and then Shane's going to read a little bit, and then he's going to describe the end of it, because it's a long passage. So anyway, Luke picks up this passage, right? And he's telling the story. Just last week we heard about the birth of Christ. The angels announce it's coming, his coming. The shepherds are sent. The shepherds go and they see what's happened. It says that Jesus is born and that Mary and Joseph are kind of awed by the whole set of circumstances. Then we're picked up in the second part of this passage after Christ has been born. Luke tells us that it's the eighth day, which is commonly the time where the child is circumcised and then consecrated, at least the firstborn, unto God. And so Mary and Joseph, being devout and faithful Jews, are enacting the way that they understand the law and what their responsibilities are. And so they take him, and they go to the temple, and they're fulfilling in Jerusalem the requirements of the law related to him. And they make sacrifices, and then Luke will pick up here in verse 25, says this. Now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon, who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was on him. It had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he would not die before he had seen the Lord's Messiah. And moved by the Spirit, he went into the temple courts. And when the parents brought the child Jesus to do for him what the custom of the law required, and now please join me in reading in unison, Simeon took him in his arms and praised God, saying, Sovereign Lord, as you have promised, you may now dismiss your servant in peace. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in sight of all nations, a light of revelation to the Gentiles, and the glory of your people Israel.
The child's father and mother marveled at what was said about him. Then Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, The child is destined to cause the falling and rising of many in Israel, and to be a sign that will be spoken against, so that the thoughts of many hearts will be revealed, and a sword will pierce your own soul too. Then in the rest of the passage, we have a lady named Anna who enters in, who's also watching for God's consolation as well, with a circle of people around her that is described as she gives praise based on what she's just seen happen. And then she goes and she spreads the news to all these people who are also waiting for God's redemption to come to his people. In verse 38, it says that she spread the news to all who were looking forward to the redemption of Jerusalem, tying it back together to what Simeon himself was looking for. So it's an exciting passage we're going to dive into here.
Mm-hmm. By the way,
there was some dispute this morning whether Thelonious Monk played trumpet or piano.
He's abusing me because I totally said, what does Thelonious Monk play, like, trumpet? And everyone was like, you're such a loser.
I didn't know either. So.
Yeah. So anyway, so I showed myself. Sorry, just messing with you. Okay. So listening to this passage, you know, oftentimes we ask for feedback from y'all, and oftentimes we get very specific kinds of interactions. But in the spirit of jazz and in the idea of listening for motifs and themes or threads, let me ask you broadly, what themes do you hear Luke trying to cause us to reflect on, to resonate somewhere in our souls, as music oftentimes is the currency of the soul? What are you hearing in this passage? What did you see reading it and what we recited? Come on. Waiting? Okay, you want to say anything else about that? Okay, so there's a sense in which God's timetable is manifesting and playing out. And in relationship to God's plan for creation to playing out, they've been in a pretty profound season of waiting, which is a major theme of Advent. We understand that. Good, good. Thank you. Larry. Oh, isn't that an amazing passage where he says, Lord, now dismiss your servant in peace. Do you understand what he's saying there? I give you permission to let me die. How many of us are that at peace with where we are that we would have a posture where we'd say to God, God, you have fulfilled your promises to me. Now, I'm ready to expire in peace. It's beautiful. It's really extraordinary. You guys are in the game too, you know. Okay, yes, Phil. Yeah. There's definitely this theme or motif of faithfulness going on there. Simeon living his life in the temple, waiting for the promise of God. And then God's fulfillment of that thing, God's faithfulness, that he actually enacted the very thing that he had promised he would do. That's a pretty great thing. Awesome. A great observation. Yeah, Jeff. Yeah, the scope of salvation in this passage is really great. In the song, it even says, a light for the Gentiles. In the glory of Israel, the scope of God's salvation plan somehow, which is pretty extraordinary given the political environment of Israel in the first century, that there's someone in the temple ready to say God's salvation includes Gentiles. There's really something there. Good. Yeah, David. There's a dark theme underneath this whole thing, too. Simeon's blessing to Mary. Do you want to say anything more about that? There's a sense of fulfillment, and there's like an off-key note that's being played that somehow is going to weave in here. Yeah, Peggy. Yeah. Yeah. So there's Peggy's just kind of doing more variations on this theme in terms of this idea of the fulfillment of this prophecy being something that actually produces pain, both as a mom and in the scope of salvation history. Maybe just one more. Somebody up there feeling a little brave? No. Last one. Yeah. Okay, so there's something really significant about Simeon recognizing here. Okay, so as I read this passage, one phrase, sometimes the Holy Spirit does this thing where when you're reading along, all of a sudden your eyes or your heart stops on a word. And for me this time, the word that I really got caught up on is consolation. The theme that I want to explore. It's in verse, where am I here? Verse 25. Now there was a man in Jerusalem called Simeon who was righteous and devout. He was waiting for the consolation of Israel. When you hear that word consolation, what comes to mind? Just say again. A price? A prize. So like some kind of consolation prize. Something secondary. I hadn't thought of that. Good. Somebody over here raise their hand. Second place. Wow. I hadn't even thought about that. I don't think that's what he's trying to say. Hey, you know what? I wish you would have gotten first place, but you get Jesus instead. Yeah. Comfort. Okay, good. Comfort. I'm liking this variation of the theme. Yeah. Any others? Peace. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't know what comes to mind for you, but consolation is this idea of presence and comfort. That you're being consoled. When there is something that is off kilter, emotionally in your life, spiritually in your life, relationally in your life, there are times when it's upending to us. And as a result of that, to be consoled means to be given comfort, and particularly in light of relationship. You know, I think about this pastorally at this time of year. It's really great to have everybody home, and we sing songs that are celebrative and exciting. But I know for an extraordinary number of people, the Christmas holidays are extremely painful time. It could really be brutal. And for many people, it's very depressing for all kinds of different reasons, but oftentimes because our expectations are so high. And it's also a time where we have to reckon with loss. I was reading The Star a couple weeks ago, and on December 8th, there was this feature on the back of the FYI section. The title of the article was Holiday Heartache. And the subtitle was Grieving for a Loved One Can Be Intense During a Season of Joy. And the author says this: images of extended families gather around a holiday table, and they surround us. For many, these generously feed into a joyous anticipation of what is to come. Yet for others, such images only serve to magnify the pain associated with the death of someone much loved and much missed. Coping with grief during the holidays can be especially difficult. I call the holidays centering moments in our lives, says Deirdre Lewin, director of critical illness and bereavement services for a family center in Connecticut. Our associations with the holidays are of families being together. Now with the death of a loved one, there is a gap, an empty seat at the table, a missing voice. Holidays are supposed to be joyful times, and the comparison between these external trappings of joy and togetherness and the internal feelings of not feeling joyful intensifies the grief and isolation and the loneliness terribly. That for as many people that are really excited, and this is a time of joy, there are just as many people who are filled with profound longing at the holidays and have to reckon with the fact of pain in their lives for what is missing. It's even ironic that at a time when we are celebrating life so profoundly that we are often emotionally, and this is stuff we don't often share with people because there's a certain degree of pressure where you feel like you have to be in tune with the spirit of the day, right? And so oftentimes people who are in this place suffer in silence, and which only increases their loneliness. But we are reminded, I think, at a time that's meant to celebrate life, of death and loss. But see, the thing is I do not think that this is a bad thing. To be reminded of our mortality, of what is missing in our life, that's almost what I believe Luke is getting at by describing in this passage Jesus in this way, as the consolation to Israel. See, the reality is that death is part of what it means to live. Folks, every one of us here are going to die. It is a reality of our existence. To die is to live. That death is a part of the living process. And the thing that's extraordinary to me about this passage is how at peace Simeon seems to be with the simple reality that we in our culture feel like we're at war about. And there's no doubt that death is the enemy and that Christ overcomes death. And yet there's something about it too that I think we're profoundly removed from. You know, this has been a really challenging fall for me in the pastoral role that I play in this community. We're a young congregation, and most of what I do sacramentally with people at a pastoral level is that I marry people and that I baptize people, babies and adults. I very rarely, in my experience as the pastor of this community, have had to deal with death. But in the last 2 months, I've performed 3 funerals. And it's been this, and I don't know if wake-up call is the right word, but it's caused me to reflect on the fact that I often live my life without the specter of death in front of me. And I don't mean that, I'm not saying that I should live in fear of that, but just with the recognition that death is part of what it means to be a human being. I want to tell you 3 quick stories about this fall. One of them is about this woman named Sydney Penner. Sydney, about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, I was walking out in the foyer, and I literally came around the corner like we often do around here in the cramp for space, and bam, I ran smack into this woman. And I was like, excuse me. And then I looked up, and she looked up, and I was like, Sydney? She's like, Tim? And I don't know who is more surprised, for her to see me as the pastor of this church, or for me to see her in this church. We went to junior high and high school together, and for those of you who know me, that I would end up as a pastor after the career that I had as a junior high and high school student is really a bit odd. And I knew enough about Sydney's story to know that this was the last place that she would ever be. And yet she had gone through this amazing transformation in her life, had married a man named Noel Villanueva. They had two children, Cheyenne, who was 12, and Reno, who was 5. And they had found God somehow. God had found them, and they had somehow located here without any connection to me or the past that we had. And so they sat in the back and just kind of slowly got wrapped into the life of our community. And then as happens around here, last April, they just disappeared. Sometimes people just stop coming. You don't know. You hope you didn't make them angry or, you know, whatever. But a lot of life happens, and sometimes it even takes like a month to realize you haven't seen somebody for a while. And then all of a sudden, I wonder what happened to them. Well, then in September, I got a phone call. Saturday morning, 8:30, my phone rings. Penner on the caller ID. Didn't even think about it being Sydney. Pick up the phone. Hello? Tim, this is Mike Penner, Sydney's dad. Yeah, hi. I'm at the hospital. Noel just died an hour ago. 36-year-old father of two, married to Sydney. And all of a sudden, we're invited to enter the reality of death in somebody's life. 36-year-old fathers of two aren't supposed to die at that stage in life. And yet, this was a profoundly holy experience for me to enter. Nathaniel and Andrea Dermeyer, an amazingly sweet couple that go to our church that are here tonight sitting here with us. They get married last spring. As sometimes happens in people's life, they get pregnant on the honeymoon. And pretty quickly begin to discover that there's something wrong with the pregnancy. And so Andrea is put on bed rest. And then she has the baby at 19 weeks, which means lungs aren't developed. And they name him Abel, which is a Hebrew word that means breath, because he's struggling to breathe. And yet they want God to fill him with breath. And so he's in intensive care at Research for three and a half months, and I'm able to visit him a couple times. We go over there. And then it seems like really everything's on the up and up. And they are released, and they take him home, and it's just glorious to get the emails from Nathaniel chronicling Abel's improvement, and they just take him in for a checkup. The doctor says, we've got a problem. He's not metabolizing oxygen. I'm not using the right words. I'm not a doctor. But his body's not absorbing the oxygen from the bloodstream that he needs to do. So they admit him into Children's Mercy, and he spends a week there, at which point at the end of the week, they say, your son's never going to breathe off a respirator. And they call me, and we go over there, and we pray. And then they make the excruciatingly difficult decision that they're going to turn off the respirator and allow their son to enter eternity with God then. And we gather around his grave, and we commit his little body, earth, back to earth. And it's just profoundly sad and profoundly holy and deeply good experience. The last one is my friend Ruthie Harrison. I went to high school with Ruthie. I went to college with Ruthie. She helped plant this church. She lost her dad about 2 years ago. She was coming over for Thanksgiving to eat with us, and we got a phone call from her the night before Thanksgiving on a Tuesday night. Her mom had been having chest pains. She lived in New York, 75-year-old woman. She went to the hospital. They took her in. The next morning, she seemed okay. Her blood pressure levels out. They send her home, and David, her brother, starts calling around noon in Dallas just to make sure she got home. Okay, no answer. 1 o'clock, no answer. 2 o'clock, no answer. 3 o'clock, no answer. I mean, you see where this is going. Finally, at 5 o'clock, David calls the police and says, listen, my mom just got released from the hospital. She's gone home. I think that there's something gone. I give you permission to break in, whatever you need to do. And so at 5 o'clock, the police get themselves in the door, and sure enough, Ann has died on the couch. Day before Thanksgiving, and Ruthie and her brother come over, and we as a community of people just share a Thanksgiving meal around a table and reflect on loss and even laugh and do those things. This is life, folks. And when we read this passage about Jesus being understood as the consolation of Israel, that we're in a context in the scriptures where the people of God have been suffering. You read Isaiah chapter 40, and God describes the coming salvation this way. Comfort, comfort my people, says your God. Speak tenderly to Jerusalem and proclaim to her that her hard service has been completed, that her sin has been paid for. She has been received from the Lord's hand double for all her sins. And then a voice of one calling in the wilderness, prepare the way for the Lord. the passage that begins to animate John the Baptist's ministry. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Consolation. See, in the Greek there, I looked it up in the scriptures, and the word that Luke chooses to use there, some of you might recognize this word, consolation, parakleison. Consolation. If you don't recognize that word, you might recognize the context from John chapter 14. Jesus is trying to prepare his disciples for his going away, and he says, it's better for you that I go. In fact, when I go, I will send another in my place. Parakletos, Holy Spirit, a comforter. And so Jesus here, Luke tells us, is given as comfort, as the fulfillment of God's promise to Israel to bring consolation for all their suffering and all their loss. God offers himself. He comes in and he says, I am here. And Simeon sees this child, and it's the fulfillment of God's promise to him. Parakleison, I come comforting and consoling with my presence. He is the God who comes alongside, the God who enters our suffering. Isaiah will say it in another way, Emmanuel, God with us. The Hebrew there, M, the preposition with, man, the pronoun us, L, the designation for God, with us God, Emmanuel. With us, God. That's who he reveals himself to be. The consolation, the comforter who enters our suffering and our pain and takes up residence. In fact, that's why Jesus says, hey, I offer a means of consolation as long as you're in my presence. But it's better that I go because I'm going to send a comforter who will dwell within you. That you will never lack for my Emmanuel-ness. That I will be with you. That I will be your consolation. Simeon's response to this is peace. God tells him in a promise, you will not see death before you first see life. And so Simeon spends his time looking for life in the temple, waiting for God's arrival. And that is what he puts all his places, that's where he puts all his hope, all his trust, all his energy in. He says, my eyes have seen the consolation that is coming. Shane, man, take off.
Let me get this stuff out of your way. I love the way that idea of consolation, it meets our community in such a profound way right now. As you guys can tell, we've just had some incredibly significant things happen in people's lives, and consolation is such a powerful theme for us right now. And that really is really good for Advent too, as we talked about Advent being a time of waiting. And there's this book that we've been reading a lot from, especially in the call to worship time during worship, called Watch for the Light. I think Ben described it a little bit this morning. And it ties into one of the three key ideas that I saw as I was reading this passage. And as Tim and I were talking a little bit, the first thing that stuck out to him was this idea of consolation. And the first thing that stuck out to me was this idea of salvation. And we realize these things are really intricately wedded in this passage. And there were three ways that I saw this consolation and salvation being played out in this passage. I saw salvation as light, salvation as redemption, and salvation as presence. And the consolation of presence. So in this essay, Watch for the Light, I thought, wow, that really ties right in with this passage. And as I thought about it more, I realized, well, of course, it's Advent. That's what we're doing. It's in a dark time in Israel's history and in a corollary in some ways to our history as we're waiting for the coming that Advent describes to us. And as I thought about the passage a little bit more and in this the cover here of this book saying, Watch for the Light, I realize, you know, what we really see is a watchman, someone who is actively waiting and looking for the light to come. And if you guys have seen, I know all of you have seen Return of the King, because this is Jacob's well, but it struck me, and if you haven't, you need to very soon. There's a scene there where you have Aragorn, the king, waiting, who's not currently inherited his throne. He's waiting to see the signal flare up on the mountains that's going to tell him that, hey, this other group of people are going to rally to support his people in this great battle that's about to take place. And Aragorn drops everything and runs full speed back. I mean, this king, this regal man, runs full speed back into this hall where these other leaders are gathered and runs up and says, look, the Gondor, the signals have been lit. Gondor calls for aid. And I thought, I thought, wow, I wonder if Simeon was in some ways very similar to that, watching, expectantly hoping for hope to come, for this signal, this fire, this light to come. And I reflected a little bit more, and I thought, you know, we see Simeon being dismissed here. We see him saying, God, now dismiss your servant in peace. And I thought, I suspect Simeon represents a long line, generations of people that were watching just for this thing. It's not clear from the passage, but it rings out to me that this might be happening, that there's been people waiting and waiting and passing on this tradition of watching in the temple faithfully, waiting for God's presence to arrive throughout many generations and centuries, and he happens to be the one that receives the climax of that in his life there, and he is discharged from service at that point. And it reminds me a little bit of just the idea of watching. In my own prayer time, there's a psalm that continually pops into my head, and it's Psalm 130, and it describes this idea of watching like this. In one of the verses in it, it says, I wait for the Lord, my soul waits, and in his word I put my hope. My soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen wait for the dawn, more than watchmen wait for the dawn. And just this theme of watching. Watching for the light, watching for the dawn. I wonder if maybe this was a part of Simeon's daily meditation as he was waiting and watching and soaking himself in the scriptures. I wonder if this is part of what formed his vocation. And as I looked at this passage too, at the beginning of Luke, this whole thing is really about these expectant, faithful people waiting for God's salvation to come. And I saw this same idea in the Zechariah song. At the end of Zechariah's song that Tim preached on 3 weeks ago, it says that we're waiting for the dawn to arise from on high and to guide our feet into the way of peace, and that will bring light to those in dark places. And I thought, you know, this is a consistent theme here, this light, this salvation as light idea here. And the really exciting thing is in this passage, this is a thing that's universal. It's broadcast to everybody. It's broadcast to people that frequently before this were completely outside of God's plans from the perspective of these people. The Gentiles and Israel, as Tim pointed out, this is a revolutionary pronouncement that light is coming to bring revelation to all peoples, and which is a powerful theme that just grips us even now as people in the Christian faith. It also reminds me of just this idea of light. It recalls many passages in John's Gospels. And you see this pop, once you start thinking about this, you see it pop up all through the Bible, and especially the New Testament. But in John's Gospel, in chapter 3, we're all familiar with John 3:16. It's a powerful statement of God's plan for us, but we don't really read past that very often. We usually quote that and stop after the next verse or two. But at the end of that section, there's a powerful statement about light made. It says, it's in John 3:19. This is the verdict. Light has come into the world, but men love darkness instead of light. It goes on to say, everyone who does evil hates the light and will not come to the light for fear that his deeds will be exposed. But whoever lives by the truth comes to the light so that it may be seen plainly that what he has been done through God. And it really is what we're saying here. And Simeon ties us in this dark passage that he's about to speak to Mary, that Jesus is the touchstone of character, that what is really true inside of you and what is really true about your nature and your character is revealed in your response to Jesus' revelation, to this light, whether you enter into it or recoil from it. And we see all throughout the Gospels, we see this statement of Simeon being enacted, played out, this Jesus being appointed for the falling and the rising of many, and a sign to be opposed, the thoughts of many to be revealed in verse 35. We see this among the religious leaders in contrast to the humble, often blatantly sinful outsiders that respond to Christ, that come towards him because they know, just like the sinners at Levi's sinner party in Mark chapter 2 and in Luke chapter 5, I think it is, that we see these people get together and Jesus said, I didn't come for the righteous. I came for those who know they need salvation, for those who know that they need redemption. And this leads into this idea of salvation as redemption that marks this passage, that even brackets this passage, as we talked about earlier, that there at the beginning of this passage, Simeon is longing for the consolation of Israel. And then at the end, we see Anna's circle of people longing for the redemption of Jerusalem, really kind of unpacking what has been described in this section here, this longing for God to come and deliver and rescue. And we often think of this idea of salvation as redemption. We think of it merely in the negative sense, which it's a deliverance and a rescue from something, from slavery and from separation and even from exile in the context of the people here. But we don't often go further and realize that that's just half of the story of redemption. There's really a two-act situation taking place in the salvation process. There's a redemption from something, and then there's a redemption towards something. And what that gets at is this idea of presence, because we're released from slavery and separation. That's the first part of this two-act segment of salvation. And then we're restored to relationship. That's the second part of this two-act play of salvation. We're restored to relationship with God and with other people. Things are brought to a point of restoration. Things are made right. This is what this idea of salvation gets at, that it's a release from something that we couldn't deliver ourselves from, and it's a restoration and a bringing to wholeness that we long for. And it's important to remember that there's a huge path. There's a huge idea that's going on there that's often overlooked. And this idea of restoration to relationship, or reconciliation is another way that we put this, it really gets at the idea that God's consolation, it's not merely a program or a series of events that God could have set in place that impersonally brought things to a state of rightness. No, it actually is a person, a human being that comes and arrives on the scene in such a tactile, real way that Simeon, this ancient watchman, can take him in his arms and hold him and say, "This is God's salvation." And this is what Yeshua is, Jesus, Yeshua, God's salvation in human form, come to bring relationship and restoration to us. And so this leads into this third idea that I saw here. Salvation is presence, that Tim talked about a little bit, with the consolation being presence. And what happens so often in these situations where people are the bereaved loved ones that have lost someone, is happening in our community, that what's missing there is the presence of the person you've lost. There is a relationship that is broken, and you long to be in contact with their presence, but you can't. And this is what produces that grief, that longing, that desire to be with that person. And that gets at what's lonely about holidays, too, in terms of losing a loved one, and also in just being separated, maybe at a distance from those that you care about, that is so hard on the holidays. That the idea of the holidays is to be with someone, just like God is calling Jesus Emmanuel, God with us. We long to be with the beloved, with them. And all these longings that we have, in some sense, they're tributaries of a deeper and more profound longing to be with the person we're created to have a relationship with, to be in relationship with all of our loved ones here and departed, and to be in perfect relationship with God, even as it was intended to be since the creation. C.S. Lewis has a quote in his book, Surprised by Joy, that's profound, that describes the idea of joy as not just a happiness. Joy is something that runs so much deeper, and he talks about it being actually a peculiar kind of longing or grief even, that it's something that deeply, deeply satisfies us, or a deep longing to receive that satisfaction that we've experienced in different ways before. And it just brings home the idea that it's all about presence and being restored to presence and relationship. And so that's just a real exhortation to us at Advent, that we're waiting and longing for presence, because this is what this word Advent means. It's a Latin word that translates another word from the New Testament that means presence, that we're waiting for this coming, the presence to be restored, and we're longing, and we're actually looking and participating in the second act of this redemption process, the restoration to relationship and presence. And this is what we're doing in our watchman vocation as we wait like Advent sentinels for God to bring his light again. And to wrap up, I want to read a passage from Isaiah again. And Isaiah, it just, gosh, it's weird how Isaiah just pops up all through these Gospels. It's like the life flow that feeds what these guys, these people are writing about. They were formed and shaped so much by their scriptural traditions in Isaiah and the Psalms and the rest of them that it bleeds out of them when they write. And I think you'll see the similarities. I'm going to read from Isaiah 52, verse 7 through 10. How beautiful on the mountains are the feet of those who bring good news, who proclaim peace, who bring good tidings, who proclaim salvation, who say to Zion, your God reigns. Listen, your watchmen lift up their voices. Together they shout for joy. When the Lord returns to Zion, they will see it with their own eyes. Burst into songs of joy together, you ruins of Jerusalem, for the Lord has comforted his people. He has redeemed Jerusalem. The Lord will lay bare His holy arm in the sight of all the nations, and all the ends of the earth will see the salvation of our God.
Shane, that's when Shane started talking about the idea of salvation as presence, the thing that came to my mind is just that idea of, in the Old Testament, the word for the face of God is panim, which also means presence. So all throughout the Old Testament scriptures, we hear the admonition, seek your face, O Lord, right? And basically what it's saying is come into the presence. And so God offers Himself as salvation, like what Shane is saying. And that in Simeon, what we see is somebody who has spent his entire life, and Anna too, seeking God's salvation. So that when God actually shows up in the temple, they recognize Him. I mean, isn't it ironic? The idea of the temple, right, is what? The place where God resides, His presence resides. So apparently all these people are at church hoping to serve God. And God shows up, and the only people who notice Him are two old people about to die. I mean, talk about adventures and missing the point, right? But there's something about Simeon and Anna. They've spent their lives seeking the face of God and longing for presence so that when presence arrives, ah, consolation, salvation, God with us. Okay, so Shane and I have just reflected a little bit, just some of the themes and motifs that have stood out to us. Now, I'm curious. We usually ask for feedback on the front end of a message. I'm curious, maybe just a couple closing comments from people. Things that stand out to you in listening to this. Reflections, comments, just thoughts. Maybe some people that haven't shared yet, or if you're just burning in their stomach, then we'll acknowledge you. Just feedback.
Or even if you're not burning.
Or even if you're not burning inside. But we want to invite you into the riffing. In the variation. Yeah. Yeah, she's saying how this idea of waiting and how God, in this passage from Brennan Manning that we read, just God kind of sneaks in, and yet our vocation as people is to wait. Isn't it so easy, folks, to stop waiting for God and try to secure consolation for ourselves? I mean, think about Simeon waiting and waiting and waiting. You wonder if he wavered as this watch person. How easy it is to grab a hold of the things that we think will console us in an attempt to create our own salvation.
It's a real illustration of faithfulness.
Of faithfulness, absolutely. Powerful good. Way. Good. Other, just any other? I mean, we don't have to do a whole lot. Yeah.
I was going to say something about what she said, and then that's interesting, too, because I was having a conversation with some people recently, and we talked about the idea of this God kind of sneaking him in, and it's almost like God went under the radar. Like, no one could really resist or put up an opposition to a baby. And yeah. God works that way so many times, but if you're proud and you're not willing to look at the way God acts, you would totally overlook that and you dismiss it. And I think that's a powerful thing.
That's a good word. Yeah, living expectantly that God would arrive and show up. Yeah, good. Yeah. Yeah, we live in the presence of God.
Mm. Yeah, Phil kind of hit on that too with the idea of this fulfillment taking place here. This promise was fulfilled.
Yeah,
it's powerful to reflect on that. It shapes the way we act now too.
Yeah, just one or two more. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems like somebody mentioned that this morning, that, it seems like the last two songs, the people intended to be encouraged are not necessarily the shepherds or Simeon and Anna. It's Mary and Joseph.
Hmm.
God is consoling them. Yeah, last one right here. Yeah. Any comments?
No, this is good stuff.
Yeah,
we should do this more often.
Doesn't it force us to ask the question, what are we hoping and waiting for?
Hmm.
I mean, and what have we placed our trust and our hope, and are we willing to be patient in the waiting for the fulfillment of that in God's timing?
Hmm.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're going to thank you all for participating with us in this experiment. It's been really fun. And we're now going to come into communion, which is really a great thing to do in light of this. Because in essence, what Shane talked about, the idea of the consolation of presence, paraclesis, the idea of Emmanuel, God with us. In the sacrament of communion, we recognize the presence of God in the midst of these elements. That in a sense, what Jesus makes is himself even continually available. That as we take communion, we are invited into the presence of God through this sacrament, the panim. We're seeking the face of God, again, in a mysterious way. Who would expect God as a baby? Who would expect God in the shape of a broken Savior? And so we take a loaf of bread and we break it. We say, this is our Savior, Jesus, broken for us. We take a cup and we say, this is blood shed for us. Who would guess? And yet in these sacraments, we're reminded of the path to Christ, his suffering, his power, his redemption, and as a result of that, reconciliation. We are given presence. We are given access to seek God's face and to come face to face with him. And isn't it ironic that throughout the whole Old Testament, nobody gets to see the face of God? And then, excuse me, I'm quoting somebody else. Now any jackass can see the face of God? I mean, really, the mule, anybody. It's like all of a sudden, even Moses couldn't see him. The ultimate prophet of Israel has to watch God go by from behind. Now all of a sudden, anybody can pursue and seek the face of God. And that as we come to the table of Christ, we also get to access the presence of God. And here's the last thing. I know we've been talking a long time. This is one of those long riffs on the album, you know. That in order to access the presence of Christ, it has to be mediated through another human being. Someone stands there and serves us. In other words, we have to make eye contact with somebody. God reconciles us to himself and reconciles us to each other. When you come up to communion, I dare you tonight to receive it by looking the other person in the eye and allowing you to enter their presence as they share with you the presence of Christ. Throughout communion, we've been doing this by using this time as silence, to meditate, to listen to our hearts, to what God has said among us, and also to enact the story that we're a part of. Israel was in a time of absolute silence, longing to hear God's voice, but God had been silent for century upon century upon century. And as we come to communion tonight, we will sit in silence as we wait to go forward and receive communion. And then as that time comes to an end, then Mike will lead us in a song. So let me share with you from 1 Corinthians 15.